So welcome everybody. Thanks for coming to this second workshop on dependent origination. Last time Sansanin gave a really wonderful introduction to dependent origination and talked about two of the links, ignorance and intention, which can be thought of to be past conditioning that we bring into the present moment. And when you guys did your presentations, your creative presentations, you were showing all the different ways we come into the present moment with certain conditioning, certain biases, certain hopes, certain dreams. And they color this moment. Tonight, we're going to, we have a lot to cover. We're going to cover links 3 through 10, which are Buddha's analysis of how we can get caught or free ourselves when we encounter this present moment. Okay, I'd love to start with a show of hands. How many people's eyes glaze over just by hearing the phrase, the 12-link chain of dependent origination? It certainly has been the case for me. So I'm going to try really hard to not present this in the way that I first started reading about it a number of years ago. So before we actually get into these links, I want to go back to something that Sansanin already talked about a little bit in the first talk, and that was how Buddha spoke about dependent origination in general. He said, when there is this, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So this is a really important way to look at this whole teaching that he developed. Everything arises and ceases according to constantly changing conditions. We know that everything's constantly changing. So certain conditions have to come together for something to appear. And when some of those conditions change, something disappears. One of the first koans we work on with students is called appearing and disappearing. This is the same thing. He talked about arising and ceasing. We sometimes talk about appearing and disappearing. So I'm going to kind of belabor this a little bit, because we tend to think of cause and effect being sequential linear things. This one thing causes that thing. You made me happy. You made me mad. That's all there is to it, right? It doesn't work that way according to the 12-link chain. So my wonderful flame lighter is going to just show us in excruciating detail how a flame might appear and how it will disappear. We all know how this is going to turn out, but I want us to look at this in terms of these multiple conditions coming together. So, thank you, Sansanin. In her left hand, she has a matchbox with a strike plate on it. In her right hand, she has a match, and we have a room full of air. We know it takes a match. We have to strike the match. We have to have air for a flame to appear.
And you need a pyromaniac.
Yes, that comes later.
Oh, okay.
You're jumping ahead a little bit here. So if Sansanin just holds up the match to the air, nothing happens. Air and match, but no friction. Same thing with the matchbook. But by the combination of all three, and a little luck, and a pyromaniac, voila, we have a flame. Now, she blew it out, momentarily denying the air's access to it, and it ceases. Let's give her a hand. So multiple conditions coming together, you change even one of the conditions and it ceases. This is dependent origination. Not very complicated when we look at it in a simple way like this. But if we look just a little bit closer, we can look at all three of these elements and start seeing that there's more conditioning that happens. So if we look at just that friction on the strike plate, what else did we need? We already got a hint over here. We need a pyromaniac. We need someone to provide that friction. So in order for that particular flame to appear, we needed Sansani, which means she needed what? Her parents, all of her ancestors. She needed to feed herself. She needed water. She needed to have an interest in Zen just to be in the room tonight in order to strike that match. If we look at the match itself, it's made of something. It's made of wood. So there needed to be trees, soil, water, sunshine to nourish the trees, somebody to harvest the trees, somebody to manufacture the match, somebody to distribute the matches to a hotel where this particular matchbook came from. I picked this up in Korea. Why? Because I had a matchbook collection when I was a kid, and when I see them, I'm interested in them. All of these things have come together. What's even more profound, which we take for granted, is the air in the room. So we need all of the cosmic conditions that brought about the formation of Earth, the development of an atmosphere. We can go out farther and farther and farther and farther and farther. So as Sansini said in her first talk, nothing exists separately from anything else. Everything is connected according to Buddha's insights and the 12-link chain, or just dependent origination. He would, I think, go so far as to say the entire universe has come together to make that flame appear, both in terms of time, all the things that led up to the conditions, and in terms of space. Pretty profound. It's really impossible for us to cognitively see all the ways this reaches. But this is Buddha's insight. One of the other teachings he had, which you may have heard of, is Indra's net. It's a metaphor for how this works. And the symbol of Indra's net is imagining a net, like a fisherman's net, stretching throughout all of infinity, and where all of the knots come together in this net is a shiny jewel. And each jewel is reflected in all of the other jewels. So everything arises together. Everything, if something ceases, it's because there are changes in all these things. I'm not sure about the changes in all these things, but conditions change. So arising and ceasing. As it works with the 12-link chain, the point I want to make, which is why I asked everybody if their eyes glazed over like mine did, you know, we have this Indian tradition of Buddhism, which was an oral tradition. Originally, in Buddha's time and place, when he was teaching, they weren't writing anything down. So they learned the teachings, they compressed them, and they turned them into numbered lists. So if you already know the teaching of dependent origination or the 12-link chain, you can remember it much easier if you turn it into a list of 12 things, and then shorthand labels. One of the issues for us is if we don't know what those labels stand for, it just becomes this list that makes our eyes glaze over. With the 12-link chain in particular, if that wasn't bad enough, it's a list that starts at 1 and goes to 12, and then one of the first things we learn is don't think of it sequentially. So that's one of the reasons I really wanted to emphasize this arising together. And I want to look at it that way, in hopes that it stops being a list for you. Because if it's just a list, it can't help us. Can't help us. I want to look quickly at how Siddhartha formulated the 12-link chain. He actually formulated it before his awakening. He's a brilliant person, obsessed with this question of suffering. He said, "I only teach suffering and the transformation of suffering." So this 12-link chain was formulated over a great deal of time. He started by asking this question, where does suffering come from? What causes it? He started with old age and death. And one of the things I found in looking into this was that old age and death is a shorthand label. Much like the word dukkha, when you think dukkha, dukkha equals suffering. Dukkha is actually a shorthand label for a whole list of things that can cause suffering to arise. And in the same way, old age and death also, according to early sutra, Buddha said, it also includes sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So essentially, Buddha started with his foremost question, why is there suffering in the world, and what can be done with it? So as the early sutras say, he began, when he was meditating on these deep questions, by asking himself, when what exists, does old age and death come to be? If things arise together and cease together, what else is there? So he meditated on it and realized, birth. If you don't make birth, old age and death don't appear. Then he went again and sat down and said, when what exists does birth come to be? Meditated on it, and something came to him. He said, coming into being, and coming into being, something being created, birth exists. And he went all the way back to ignorance. As we talked about last time too, it's now taught as a 12-link chain, but it's been done in any number of numbers. But the general, by the time these sutras came down to us, it was a 12-link chain, and this is how he did it. He checked his work by going backwards from ignorance up to old age and death. And that's him working out, essentially proving to himself the second noble truth. What's the source of suffering? So this 12-link chain, if we attach to any of these links, suffering arises. What he really wanted to know is what we can do about it. So he did the very same thing. Asked himself in another way, when what does not exist, does aging and death not come to be? Eventually he realized with the cessation of birth, old age and death ceased to be. Went back through it again. So he realized there was a path to liberation. Suffering comes from, has a source, and there's a way to be cured from that. And of course, the fourth noble truth, as Sansanim talked about, was the Eightfold Path, which we've taught before and we will teach again at some point, but not tonight. So this is a very detailed analysis of how this works. I want to just underscore a couple of points. Again, while there is this numerical system, it can appear that this is a linear sequence with one cause leading to one effect, but it's not the case. I think it's better to think of it as literally as a chain reaction. So I brought an actual 12-link chain of dependent origination with me tonight. I went down to Stoneway Hardware and asked them to give me the most beautiful, desirable gold, pure gold chain. And I know you all want to pick it up, but let's wait for that. This is what they came up with, not pure gold, but still very attractive. So it's a chain reaction. If you pick up any one link, all of the others arise together. And conversely, if we take any of the other links and we lay it down, the others are laid down. So this is what we're going to look into when we get into the nuts and bolts of it. As I said, we've got a lot to look at, but does anybody have any questions so far about what I've covered? Beautiful, perfectly clear. I love that. So let's start looking at the present moment. Another question for you. Of these 12 links, and feel free to look at the circular chart or the chart on the back, either way. In your own experience of these 12 links that we can attach to, where is it that we get really hooked most often? Anybody have any ideas? There's an answer I'm hoping you're going to come up with, by the way. Paul?
Clinging.
Clinging?
Name and form.
Name and form. Anybody else?
Desire.
Desire.
Feeling.
So we're getting a lot around feeling, desire, clinging. We get a lot of questions about how do we practice with feelings when they come up and they start overwhelming us. Feelings is a real, this line between feeling and desire is one that we can get really hooked by. So I want to, instead of just going from link 3 up to link 10, Sansanim and I thought it would be fun to start where we tend to grab one of these links. So let's start with feeling and take a look at it. Okay? I thought it would be kind of fun not to talk, use an example, some kind of tragic feeling that arises. So let's just take a really wonderful scenario. Let's say, for example, you wake up in the morning out of a nice sound sleep to the smell of fresh coffee, automatically made for you by your brand new 10-cup Mr. Coffee drip machine with the automatic start time feature that you set the night before. Ready? We breathe in. Ah. Wonderful feeling. So Buddha said, feelings, we all pretty much automatically have some kind of feeling from some sort of sensation. And it's either positive, negative, or sometimes it's just neutral. In this case, we all love coffee, right? Because that's why we're in Seattle, I assume. Nope. Okay, wonderful. So Jill, this is really great. You can trace through this thinking, oh my God, what if I woke up to the smell of coffee? You can imagine how this works. The point I want to make is in terms of these links arising together, and if you're following this chart, we are going to go from 7 down to 6, 5, 4, and 3. Not sequentially, but as a chain reaction. When this feeling arises, whether it's positive or negative, what also exists when that happens? What has happened? We've made contact. Buddha was really talking about the fact that one of our six senses, in this case our sense of smell, and I guess we would call it the software that allows this nose to function as a sensory organ, and the smell of coffee all come together and make contact. Sounds obvious? Wake up. So what needs to occur is we need to have contact occur between our nose, our sense of smell, and the sense object. We also need at least one of our senses. This is link 5, the six senses. In this case, it's nose. Number 4, name and form, is Buddha described as the joining of the mental and physical realms. So 5 and 4, the six senses in name and form, are not actually separate from either, from each other. They actually operate without any kind of separation. But he broke the six senses out to make the process a little bit clearer for you. And then we also need consciousness. He's talking literally about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. It's just talking about what happens when you get that feeling. All of those things have arisen. They've all appeared in our mind. Right? This sounds kind of dry and academic and mechanical. There's a reason for that, because it is. All he's doing here, from feelings down to consciousness, is he's meticulously looking at how human beings cognize any kind of sensation. Purely mechanical. Purely impersonal is one way to look at it. Okay? That doesn't mean we don't make any one of these personal. But he's really just talking about how this mind-body connection functions. Okay? Let's go the other way. Let's start looking at feelings and seeing this juicier stuff where it really gets personal. Desire, clinging, coming to being. So remember, the feelings link is just the direct experience of sensations. Positive, negative, automatic. This is an important crossroads, this point between here and desire. If we're mindful of feelings, that feelings just are a natural reaction to sensation, we fully experience it, but we don't become attached to it. It's possible to do that. Is there anybody who kind of can take or leave coffee? Eric, right? So you smell coffee and go, oh, that's kind of nice, but whatever, right? Go about your day. Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. Something else might make you want to attach to it. Jill doesn't particularly like it, so she's not going to go out. She's not going to go for it. But something else might. She might attach to. But if we attach to this feeling, desire, clinging, and coming into being also appear automatically and all together. So, with desire, it goes from having this feeling to, I want coffee, right? We've just made I, and we've also made coffee, something separate from I. Right? We started out talking about how Buddha's teaching is that everything is intimately connected. He also said there's nothing lacking. But as soon as we go, I want that, desire appears. Maybe a minute later, we start to cling to that if we really, really love it. Wait, I don't just want coffee. I need coffee. God, I'm such a wreck if I don't have my coffee in the morning. Right? So we start obsessing about it more and more. We personalize it. We start telling stories about our relationship with this thing that we've just smelled. We turn this I into something that we think has permanent characteristics. I need coffee or I can't function. So we reinforce the perceived separation between this I that we've created and the object, our desire, with storytelling. Why do I need it? We rationalize why we need it so we can continue to do this. Or I need this, or I don't like that because. So this clinging, this I need it, and the storytelling part contributes to an ongoing habit of reactions that we have. This is where it gets difficult for us in certain situations to actually just come into a situation without having a knee-jerk reaction, because we've reinforced the way this quote-unquote goes over and over and over and over again. It's why sometimes when you hear somebody start to talk, you immediately ignore them, or you get filled with anger, because you've already created in your mind a personal relationship between this thing called me and that thing that we call other. Whether it's coffee or a situation that arises, something that brings up a bad memory, or a person, for example. And then 10, coming into being, arises. So when we desire and cling to something, it comes into being. It exists in our consciousness. We've isolated this one thing out of our entire awareness. We've obsessed about it. And we've essentially created our own version of it. Very hard to remember that everything is constantly changing, so everything is fresh and new. So these habitual tendencies reinforce the existing karma that we bring into this moment. That's how we can get attached to these. Anybody have any questions about this? Jill?
I'm not grasping that concept that we create something that we desire. Not physically, you mean not consciousness?
We create it in a, we create essentially a version of it in our mind with our own relationship to
it. As we're thinking about it?
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to think of an example. Basically, there are certain things that somebody else might be fairly oblivious to because they have no particular reaction to it, and they really haven't desired it and kind of created these new karmic seeds. They're going to have a different relationship with that actual physical object than you would, or that person than you would. So this coming into being is essentially showing that our mind makes a relationship based on all of these factors. Do you have another way to
I think you said it pretty well. It's in a way just like storytelling. You create a narrative around the event of our feeling, and that becomes habitual.
True.
And the habitual quality then is leaning in towards creating new karma.
Or if we don't like something, we lean against it. We find reasons to create stories about the thing that we have a negative feeling about.
So it feels like this also relates all the way across the circle, number 4, because you know, about creating this thing, you're, by doing that, you're like picking a name, you're saying that's coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're waking up, you know, all the associations that you have about coffee and what it connects to.
Right. And the real practice, that's a really good point. You know, the truth is that all of these links actually, in a way, I mean, they're all related to each other. So you can see them in a number of different alive ways. But, you know, as we said, name and form is actually just perceiving this connection, this kind of holistic connection with the mental and the physical. But if we even look at this, if we attach to this idea of name and form, and it creates separation between this and that, me and you, me and coffee, and I like coffee, or you, I don't like coffee, we've already created the seeds for that kind of separation. And if it doesn't create suffering, it's no problem. There's a practical aspect to this, right? There is coffee in the world. It's okay to like the smell of it. It's okay to want to have a cup. But if your whole day revolves around coffee because you love it so much, it can start to enslave you. Right?
You know, if I could bring up Chicken Little again, I think that where Chicken Little says simply, the sky is falling, that's already whipping around from the feeling of something falling on Chicken Little's tail feathers, whipping around this chain reaction, as Popsini was saying. There's the coming into being of the story that the sky is falling, and then off we go.
And everything is seen through that fear. Bob?
Well, I have to say that my own experience is different from this diagram.
Okay.
Where I would start is with consciousness, that we're born with consciousness, which is originally the six senses, basically, just aware of senses. And as we grow, we learn to name and give form to things, and we develop habits. And gradually, we become less and less sensory-oriented. We have names and form and symbol to, label everything and organize everything, so we don't have to look at it
in its
uniqueness. And as adults, we end up pretty much having lost mindfulness and the senses, and being totally into form and naming and habit patterns and emotions and feelings and desire go into determining what we're attached to. So it leads to a lot of attachments.
Right.
And then insight is escaping from that realm of consciousness into a different realm of consciousness, which is back to direct, immediate sensory perception and mindfulness. And because we have lost it so much, it seems amazing and fabulous and beautiful and unique. And so, to me, the question is, how do you go from our state of consciousness of form and naming and pattern and attachment to the state of consciousness without that, without attachment, without names, without form, without habits, but immediate direct perception.
Yeah.
And so I would put the pieces together differently from this diagram.
I don't know if you were here. First of all, everything you said, I think, is wonderful and right on target. I don't know if you're here for the first talk, and one of the things that came up that I wasn't sure who was here because I was sick for that, and I just listened to the recording of it. But historically, there weren't always 12 links in this chain, and also one of the points that was made is there is no one starting point. I mean, Buddha or Siddhartha developed this by looking at the question of suffering and traced it around that way. That's the way the sutra that in which he describes it comes down to us. But according to scholars and other sources, they know that this has been taught as a 2-link chain, a 3-link chain, a 4-link chain, a 7-link chain. So one of the reasons I'm trying to talk about it this way is so we don't get too hung up on, well, 2 has to come before 3, et cetera, et cetera. But I think your general comment is right on target. All of these early links are just talking about this direct experience we have. And as you said, what happens is that we start referring to our hopes and fears, the way we've digested past information, and we refer to what's in our head and overlook what's in front of us. So while you might look at the details of it different, everything I heard you say sounds right on target.
All I'm saying is I think this actually confuses the picture because it only talks about one consciousness. It doesn't talk about two types of consciousness. It mixes name and form in with senses and contact, which I think, again, to me, you need to clearly look at how those are distinguished.
Yeah.
And lead in different paths.
Right.
And then the question is how, when you, as at least I found as an adult, I was pretty much totally into thinking, mind, naming,
right,
attachments,
right,
and not into direct mindfulness. And so
right,
the question is how do you make that jump?
Right.
Which I think meditation is one technique, but there are others. In,
right.
Yep.
Yep. That actually is a perfect segue into the whole point of this. And this is actually one of the other things. And by the way, just letting you know, we're teaching this from the tradition as it comes down to people. So I might call some of these things different in my own experience as well. And that's why I didn't want to go, okay, here's one, here's two, here's three, and have it just look, because then you're back where you started, your eyes glaze over. But your description of your own experience with that and how do we get out of that is right on. You see how we lose that freshness, we lose the ability to be in the present moment and actually have a shot at seeing what's going on. So Buddha really wanted us to understand how these links in this chain, there are parallel versions of this, by the way. So in this chart, the inside the outer circle are the ways that this conditioning arises, and these other shorthand labels outside of it, if you're looking at the round one, are his ways that we can practice getting back to just what Bob was talking about. So Buddha wanted us to understand it. What happens is people tend to talk about what we've done so far. We've talked about how we can get caught. And Buddha was mostly interested in what you just said. How do we find a way out of this? How do we find this cessation? Cessation of the things that create suffering or distress for us. And as I said, the Eightfold Path, which he talked about right after he talked about the 12-link chain, is his description of how to do that. Also requires a lot of study. But essentially, everything, our general practice, Zen practice as it comes down to us, is an ongoing practice that trains us on how to notice when we're ready to pick up a link and be aware that that's what we're doing and let go of it. I want to talk for a minute about our founding teacher, Zen Master Sung San, just as a case in point. We can throw this whole thing away if we want to and just go back to what Zen Master Sung San taught. Someone asked him what he teaches, and he said, I only teach one thing. I teach don't know. As San Sunim talked about in the first workshop, the way to practice with ignorance, that one link, is keep don't know mind. Right? And the ignorance, by the way, that he referred to, as she said, is the ignorance of dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths. So Zen Master Sung San said, just keep don't know mind, always and everywhere. And if we do that 100% all the time, we don't have to worry about ignorance, we don't have to worry about any of the other links. It's kind of tough to know what that means. And what happens is we catch ourselves attaching to any one of these links. So the teaching that's come down to us, the detailed teaching that comes down to us, shows us how we can practice if we see any of these things coming up. Feeling, which I think most of us feel is charged with personal associations, but according to Buddha, again, is just a natural reaction to stimulus. You have a reaction. I like it. It's, yeah, whatever. I can take it or leave it, or I'm not enjoying this. That's a reaction. But then we start reifying it with us. So the way to practice when we notice feeling is arising, and a number of people have asked us this question. I asked this question of my teacher, and I think it's gone down for many, many generations. But can we experience feelings just as feelings? Sounds silly to say it out loud like that, but can we experience feelings as an energetic shift? Can we experience that as sensation? And if we watch it, we notice that it also is moving. It's changing. Our fear of feelings is when we're in the middle of a strong feeling. In that moment, we think it's permanent. We're in hell all of a sudden. Right? But if we're doing, for example, formal practice, and some strong feeling comes up, and we are mindful of just seeing it as a sensation, we can learn to watch it appear and disappear if we don't attach to it. If we don't try to push it away, if it's a negative feeling, or don't try to hang on to it if it's a positive feeling, then maybe that feeling comes back. And we try to do the same thing again. So this outer circle talks about ways in our tradition we can practice with whatever appears. My feeling is if you just see this as some kind of boring list, it can't help you. But if you notice what arises in your own consciousness in any given moment, if you notice, for example, that you're so attached to your thinking that you're actually not able to see things, this is the very bread and butter of what we do with our meditation practice. We notice that we're starting to tell stories. We start by labeling something, and then we notice we're not even paying attention to the thing that is all around us, the aliveness that's all around us. So we do call this training for a reason. And the way we do it is to be aware of when attachment starts to arise and break that habitual chain reaction of just reinforcing what we've done before. And when we notice that we've, as you have called this whole Kilche workshop, how did I get into this fix? Something's really distressing us and we're really suffering. Can we look at it in this and find our own experience in it? And if we can we go back and find a way to practice with it? What happens is we trade in these knee-jerk habits. We start learning what Buddha would call wholesome habits, habits that bring a feeling of connectivity with us to the outside world, clarity. We learn to come back to this fresh moment, just maybe by taking a breath and centering ourselves. Nobody even notices that we're doing that. So I don't know if we can either, let's see what time is it. I can go through these steps and talk about these individual things. I don't know if that would be helpful for you or not. But essentially that's how we do it. Would anybody like to hear about any of these? What any of these steps are and how we practice, How do we practice? Is there one you'd like to ask about, or would you like me to just go through them? I don't want to bore people by going, and then there's step four, link of liberation.
Contact.
The contact's actually a really great one because, so contact. This is the area where Buddha was actually just looking at how our senses, whether you know our sense of sight, hearing, taste, touch, feeling, consciousness that comes into our mind, how we connect with objects in the physical realm, right? So we have an eye organ, right? Sansanin was saying, just seeing is Buddha nature recently. We have this organ called the eye. We have the faculty of sight, how that works. Maybe a medical person can explain, I can't. But somehow this eye organ has the capability to perceive. And then there is something, right now I see this black mat over there. That's contact. A connection, a seamless connection between the eye, the mind, and that object that I've noticed. Okay? Seamless, no separation. You just see it before you can even think about it. Boom. Right? That's contact. Very simple. Where we can get into trouble with contact is if we perceive that there's this thing called me that is separate from that. That's where the beginning of suffering can happen. If I perceive that that doesn't have anything to do with this thing I've called me, which I've spent my entire life nurturing and have only the best wishes for, if I perceive that cushion as something I don't like, I'm not going to treat it very well. If I see that cushion as a symbol of my hopes for enlightenment, I might start getting really a little carried away with what that cushion means. Okay? Both of these things can start, you know, and then some, you know, Jim Peasy, he always wants to sit on my cushion. That's my cushion, right? So this simple thing called contact, which is literally just a seamless direct perception, if we start reading into it, and separate that from this, things can start getting in trouble. And if you noticed in that scenario where I got overly fond of that cushion, overly protective of that cushion, desire appears, clinging appears, coming into being appears. That's my cushion. Jim's just sitting down wherever he finds a place to sit down. Trouble can start brewing. Okay? Any of these things can work that way. So we don't have to see them. We can see that they all kind of appear when one appears, and they all go away when we let them go. So another thing Zen Master Sung San said when students came up and he realized they were attaching to something, he said, put it all down. I never thought about it before this, but boy, I'm going to see that in a different way. Put it all down. Only don't know. Go straight for 10,000 years nonstop. Help all beings. Bob?
Well, since you said only don't know again,
yeah.
I just like to express a pet peeve. I really don't like that phrase, only don't know, don't know mind. It tells you what not to do instead of what to do.
Yes.
And I think it means, you know, stop thinking, stop being attached, just be in the moment with your sensory input and stuff. But I don't think it might have been a phrase that meant a lot to Sansanin, and I don't know, maybe in Korean or in some translation, but I think it's much more helpful to explain what you should do than what you shouldn't do, because anyways.
Maybe you can find, you know, actually, to me, your description a few minutes ago perfectly encapsulated that. So I mean, I guess what I would say is comment noted. But like all of these things, these phrases, they come down to us. We have to find our own relationship to it. And I thought your description a few minutes ago was wonderful about, you know, as you grow up, you become an adult, you basically are referring to your ideas about stuff, and you miss your direct experience. And coming back to your direct experience and realizing it's constantly in flux means we're actually fully present with our life, just as it is. So not knowing does that phrase in some form does find its way through a lot of Zen. But I would urge you to find a way to think about what it means.
Well, I think I know what it means.
I think you do.
I think it's a phrase that misleads a lot of people.
Yeah.
In the end, which is not good for beginning students. It's
yeah.
Confusing without help being helpful. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's some part of Zen that likes to be really confusing. It creates the mystique of it's really mysterious and wonderful, and you know, insight is fabulous. I mean, you gotta be.
Yeah.
You know, whereas
I get it.
I'm not sure it's that complicated.
Yeah.
Thank you for your opinions.
Yeah. Well, I hope tonight I tried to clarify things rather than put forth a lot of obscurity. I was trying to unpack it and really talk about that problem with labeling. We have to find out for ourselves what these things mean. So.
It does seem like that teaching, you know, take what you need, leave what you don't. And interpret it, if you're going to just spin around the words, then of course they're not helpful at
right.
all. And so then you find a word that is helpful, and then every time you hear Dhamma mind, you can say, oh, my word is ah.
I like
ah. Right. Any last questions? We're about out of time. But
I have a good question.
Yep.
Of that is like brain chemistry. You know, people who have addictions, physical addictions, or versus, you know, and I don't know. So I wonder how much of craving is chemistry versus, you know, you want to eat a cookie or something. I don't know. I'm just trying to find that fine line of things you can work on and some things that are maybe out of your control.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I certainly am not qualified to answer that question, but we all do desire things, and we do cling to things. But yeah, some people, it may be a propensity for that. Certainly alcoholism and drug addiction, there are physical components to that, as well as mental ones.
It does seem like that the 12-link chain is kind of how we grow up. It's sort of a conventional psychology, how we grow up experiencing the world and ourselves and events. And it sounds like that what you're saying is we can kind of put it down and not energize it. And then this wider circle of connectedness and experience kind of emerges.
Yeah,
there.
the positive, I mean, for lack of a better way to phrase it, that positive or liberating parallel 12-link chain. And again, I think Sunsneem did a really terrific job of putting down, if you really go back and look at the back side of that sheet, which you got before too, it really shows us how we can practice with things that come up. So, you know, pay attention to that. If you see, you know, as she said in that first one, if you find yourself with this leaning mind, either towards something or trying to lean away from it, it's a point where you can see what's really going on. and how can I practice with that? That's our ongoing, training. Lisa, you had a question.
I was just wondering if you had ever mapped this kind of this outer ring with the Eightfold Path, since this is, it's similar.
You know, I looked at that, and there's a certain point when you're dealing with this many numbers and that many numbers, and it's just like, ah.
We <Yeah. laughs>
But we'd love to see what you come up with.
To be all neat and tidy, right?
Yeah. That's very kind of you.
Yeah. So we have, in 2 weeks, we'll have another presentation by you guys. And, wow. Oh, hang on. That's my banking statement. Okay, I'm going to look at each of these and make sure I'm not passing out. Okay, these look good. If you see any bank account numbers, I trust you to be really compassionate and kind and just bring them back here. I knew I shouldn't have done that.
Donations accepted.
Oh, there's the second one. Okay, here. Website, hang on, I need one. Or maybe I can read yours. So I'm going to try to make, I tried to make this short, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. We wanted to continue kind of springboard off of that wonderful evening a couple of weeks ago when you guys came back with these really great explorations of how past conditioning works. And one of the other things we wanted to do is make sure that we veer away a little bit from Nan Xuan's cat in the next one, because some people in the room have passed that cone on and some haven't. And we don't want anybody to inadvertently create habit. So Sansanim and I picked two of the presentations we thought would be interesting to use as starting points for your next presentation. And just as you did it last time, if you want to do it using multimedia, a little two-scene play, artwork, a poem, a skit, however you want to do it. You guys are so great at it, you already know how to do this. But we picked two. Debbie talked last time about how family dynamics between a controlling husband and his wife created suffering and how it spilled over into their child. And Bob and Catherine had a narrative about politics, which began with two progressives initially agreeing about their fears and then ultimately disagreeing over whether women's rights were more important than seniors' rights. So pick, with your Dharma buddy, pick one of those two scenarios and feel free to, you know, just riff on it however you like. But we want to do it in two scenes or two parts. We want to show first how we can attach to the links of the chain, of some of the links or one of the links in the present moment, links 3 through 10, and also show another version where you don't get stuck, where liberation occurs momentarily. Hilda.
Debbie, do you have the script for yours? Because I would like to read it.
No, I just winged it.
You can.
We can't just do our own scenario.
Yeah, you can do something about family dynamics, and or do something about politics. I mean, you don't have to adhere to exactly what she said. But those are really two juicy areas where we can get really bound up in our belief systems, or we can find a way to be free of that. So I'd like to see both.
Also, how do we get stuck in it?
You did?